This is a National Museum of Australia recording. For more information, visit nma.gov.au/audio.
Hello. Hi. Welcome to the National Museum of Australia. My name's Rachel Coughlin and I look after public programs here. And now it's my pleasure to introduce Carol Cartwright, who is the president of the Museums Australia ACT branch, and she's also the head of education and visitor services at the Australian War Memorial. Thanks very much for coming.
So thank you, Rachel. Lovely to see you all here this afternoon on this cold, wintry Canberra day. Firstly, I'd like to acknowledge that we are gathering on the land of the Ngunnawal people and we acknowledge their traditions past and present. So on behalf of Museums Australia ACT branch and the National Museum, I'm delighted to welcome you today to this forum, The Future of Museum Multimedia. We've got a couple of interesting speakers lined up and it should be a great couple of hours. So, as Rachel said, my name's Carol Cartwright and I'm the President of the ACT branch of Museums Australia. And museums play a really important role in our lives, particularly as most of us gathered in this room today probably work in a museum or are a frequent visitor to one. And, of course, here in Canberra, we are surrounded by some of the finest museums and galleries in not only the nation but in the world. In my paid job, as Rachel said, I'm the Head of Education and Visitor Services at the Australian War Memorial. And I've worked in visitor services and public programs area for most of my working life. So I'm a bit of a passionate about visitors, their experiences and how we can measure them and do better with them. So I'm really interested to see how, you know, the new technologies are taking us and what's the future for us in that area. So this program today is a part of the National Museum's programming in association with this magnificent exhibition, Yawurra Kudju, the Canning Stock Route. I'm going to get it wrong, I knew that. Exhibition, and hopefully you've all had a chance to have a look at the fantastic multimedia display which forms a part of that exhibition, because these are the people that made it and this is the opportunity you've got today to listen to what went on to produce that. So Museums Australia is very happy to be in partnership with the National Museum today and to support this program. And just to let you know, the order of things we're doing today, we'll be introducing Nicole in a minute, then Michael Hill will follow, then Ticker Wilson, and then we'll open it all up for questions at the end. So sounds like a great day. So firstly, I'd like to introduce Nicole Ma, Nikki I think she likes to be called, and she's the multimedia producer and mentor. Based in Melbourne, Nicole produced and coordinated this project and with the exhibition's film and mentors the project's four Aboriginal multimedia practitioners, co-founding Blue Horse Films in New York in 1990. The company won a prestigious screenwriting award at the Sundance Film Festival. Nicole then returned to Australia and was appointed executive producer for this project. It's her this inaugural exhibition. She has a number of recent documentaries and I know she's working on another one right now. So I'm really looking forward to hearing Nikki speak. So please welcome Nikki to the microphone. Thank you.
Good afternoon, everyone. Thank you for coming. Yes, thanks, Carol, for that introduction. The Canning Stock Route is a huge, sprawling project that extended over three to four years and with a core team of about 14 people. And it was initiated by Carly Davenport and Tim Acker. And they presented the idea to FORM, which was an independent arts organisation, which is based in Perth. I just want to quote Carly, who said, "It began with the idea of the road, one track, cutting a single line across three deserts, the Great Sandy, the Little Sandy, and the Gibson. In the remote communities of these deserts, Aboriginal people have their own histories of the stock route, which they have often recorded in paintings. These artists, many of them stars of the contemporary art world, work in their communities' art centres, the small cooperatives that enable desert painters to pursue their artistic careers. It was in in collaboration with these art centres that Form proposed to set up a project dedicated to researching artists' connections with the Canning Stock Route story. So it was an ambitious idea. The Canning Stock Route runs through country, which has over 15 language groups. And whilst the story of Aboriginal art in Western Australia is also intricately woven with the Canning Stock Route. At the time, droving and drought caused many of the family groups to move out of the desert. This movement to mission towns and stations established communities living on the edge of the desert, which in turn saw the genesis and subsequent flourishing of the Aboriginal art movement. I had been working for a number of years prior to this project in Fitzroy and came on board initially as a producer for the for a six-week trip that they, that Carly and Tim proposed to do along the Canning Stock Route in July 2007. I didn't have a brief. They said to me, just film everything. So I thought, well, yes, I can do that. I took with me a cinematographer and a sound recorder. So we had our own car, and we filled up the car with as much equipment as we thought we could take, which included cranes, editing material, and we had about three or four different types of cameras. We had a convoy. The core convoy was 6 four-wheel drives, and a team of 20, which included mechanics, nurses, curators, anthropologists. Over 100 artists with familial connections to the stock route and who had historical background to countries surrounding the stock route joined us at various points. The idea was that we would have four painting camps along the route. So within the 6 weeks, we spent the first week travelling along the stock route. Then we stopped at Well 17, which is Durbar Springs, and had our first painting trip. It became a mammoth logistical exercise, as you can imagine. When we stayed at the camps for 3 to 5 days, the artists could paint. Being in country stimulated creativity and the sharing of stories. Some of these stories were handed down through family, and some were personal experiences living in country. And this is when we realized the amount of material that we were going to collect from people who had actually experienced living around the stock route and had stories of first contact, of droving, of the animals and plants that existed in that time. From the trip, the heart of the material for the project was collected, and at that time, when we realised we just had to abandon all expectations and allow the days to unfold. This film that I'm about to show you is one of about 100 interviews that we did on the route. Dusty was a drover. His country was Durbar Springs, was the first place that we stopped for our painting camp. I wanted to show this film. This is one of the films that's in the interactive, where there are over 150 films, and the range of material that we had. During the trip, I was mentor to three filmmakers who joined us, and when we stopped for the painting camps, we actually filmed what was going on, and the three filmmakers made their own films in editing studio that we set up under the trees. And they produced a number of short films that are featured in the exhibition. So this mentor program actually became one of the most important aspects of the project. The films made by the emerging filmmakers had a very fresh, live aspect to them. They lived in the communities, and the films were about their families and their lives. It was their story and showed the vibrancy and colour of their lives. So these three emerging filmmakers, plus one other who decided that he really wanted to come on board as well, Curtis Taylor, became part of our core team. So over the next 2 years, while Form was looking for financing to fund the project, which kept growing. Every time we had an idea, it required money, so Form had to go out and see if there was money to back the ideas that we had. They were also negotiating a partnership with the National Museum, and we eventually realized that it was going to become an exhibition, and that we had all this material that needed to be collated and designed to suit an exhibition. So over the 2 years, we travelled together a lot, the core team of 14. We had urban meetings, which were curatorial, where the emerging curators and the filmmakers came together and the design and shape of the exhibition were discussed and evolved. The paintings were curated, and then I came in and looked at what paintings and stories were being told through the exhibition and put in my feedback as to how I felt how the media could support those stories. After the 2 years, the Form was committed to give the artists and their families control over their knowledge and to ensure that sensitive materials were safeguarded. As a result, all the translations and community clearances of stories meant we had to take repeated visits to communities to complete this. So as we were talking to artists and communities, they said, well, if you're going to come, we might as well do workshops. So as usual, everything became bigger than Ben-Hur. It started out as we just wanted to go and get approvals to use certain stories, and then they came to us and said, well, we'd like to do a workshop. We want to paint more. We want to make artifacts. We want to sing and dance. We want to transfer the knowledge to the young people. So we ended up doing numerous workshops in all the different communities, as well as these urban meetings, curatorial meetings. All of this, the emerging filmmakers and myself, we documented workshops, meetings, approval bush trips, interviews with artists and contributors. We were collecting libraries of content. The sheer amount of material was overwhelming. Over 120 paintings, 200 hours of film, over 20,000 photos, 100 oral histories, most of them in language, were needed to be translated, maps, historical research, cultural and social data. On the one hand, we knew that this was an incredible resource for the communities in the future, as they were going to be given all their copyright material back. However, looking at it from the exhibition point of view, we were only touching the tip of the iceberg. So we started to debate how we could boil this information down so that an audience, the public, could share in it, and came up with an idea of doing, obviously, an interactive. So we started to throw around stories, and we realized that the actual white... The European side of the history of the exhibition was not being told. There were no artifacts from that time. And we were offered the use of Canning's map. And that's how the idea of a mapping interactive came about. We thought we'd layer interactives with maps because everything that the Aboriginals were painting was about mapping. Canning was about mapping, so it was an obvious choice to use the mapping as a basis for the interactive. The SIG piece merges artistic, cultural, historical, ecological, and scientific data. It's a multidisciplinary approach, but it was all tied together by the stories, that the first-person stories that the artists gave us. And the fact that they were fully involved in the project and had complete jurisdiction on what was to be told and what wasn't to be told. One of my mentorees, Curtis Taylor, said, and this is on the part of the signature piece, the missionaries, they concentrated on the kids, and that's what we are doing here. For this to start, we are using the newest technology with the oldest culture. And to me, it feels like that we've used technology in a way where we can, that we have an opportunity to embed these libraries of content And it may be that not everyone will be able to see everything that it is in, but we know that it is embedded in this way for the future, for the museum and for the public. Now, I'd like to play another film called Kanangara, which came out of one of the workshops that we did. This film is also in the signature piece. I'd just like to read you a quote from our anthropologist, John Carty, who talks about maps. Canning relied on his Aboriginal guides to map the surrounding waters in ground paintings. His own map of the Canning stock route could be seen as a symbol of colonial myopia, a ribbon of wells of native waters within a vast fabric of emptiness. Yet invisible to Canning and to most of us today were the complex fields of knowledge and information delineated within the very landscape in a detailed network of dreaming tracks. Within this matrix of stories, songs, and ceremonies, every aspect of the country was wholly mapped. Thank you.
Thank you, Nikki. We're now going to ask Michael Hill to join us. And I'm just going to check Michael. Michael's a director of Lightwell. He formed the company in 2004 and is the director. He studied painting at the National Art School and has a BA in sculpture and installation from Sydney College of Art and also works in media art. He's interested in performance and theatre as well as media production, and he's exhibited films and videos as a media artist before working with the Australian Film Commission in the mid-1990s. There he financed and oversaw the production of interactive projects and experimental media. He's produced video and interactive programs for museums and other public spaces for more than 10 years, including programs for the Australian War Memorial, and I work very closely with Michael there, the Australian Museum, the National Sports Museum, National Archives, and he's working on a couple of exciting projects at the moment. So, Michael, come and tell us all about the multimedia. Thank you.
Thanks, Carol. It's a pleasure to be here. Thanks. It's a great opportunity, actually, because we do a lot of work in museums and it's very difficult to kind of evaluate the work once it's sort of been installed. So to come along today and discuss and evaluate the project is terrific. Often to evaluate, you're kind of sidling up to groups of visitors and trying to overhear the conversations and things like that, and it either results in some strange looks or police action. So it's kind of... good not to have to face that again. The talk today is kind of, well, it's titled The Future of Multimedia in Museums, which sounds quite grand, and hopefully I'm not going to spoil the party by saying, well, you know, we're going to talk about the project that's already a little bit in the past. But maybe out of that we can kind of tease out some of these themes and talk about the future of multimedia later on. Where am I? I'm going to talk a little bit about interactive tables. For many of you, a lot of people would have already kind of interacted with some of these sorts of installations before. These are two examples from the early 2000s. The top one on the left is the numbers table at the Berlin Jewish Museum, and the bottom right is the timeline table at the Churchill War Rooms. So these kinds of installations have been around for a long time. Or a relatively long time in the scheme of museum installations. So there's a few antecedents for the project out in Uarukuju. We've also developed these kinds of things for the Australian Museum and another one here for ACME down in Melbourne. But all of these projects, you know, what's fascinating, we've kind of developed about five of them now. But this character of them being tables is very, very important. The fact that people gather around them and are used to kind of talking across tables or meeting around a table is very useful because it changes people's behaviour about how they interact with the media. The best thing about it is this kind of conversation that people have across the table when they come and start to interact with the piece. And there's all sorts of ways we've tried to develop those kinds of conversations or opportunities for conversation in the One Road Interactive. And to see it actually happen is fantastic when it happens. So being a table, that sounds really echoey. Being a table, it's on a horizontal plane, and that's one of the things as we developed the project for One Road. The fact, as Susan Freeman, the exhibition designer, sort of picked up on it, the fact that you wanted to privilege the objects of the paintings, you know, walk into the space and you see these fantastic paintings all on the vertical plane. We didn't want to kind of lessen their impact by having media on the vertical plane as well. So having it on the horizontal, you have to kind of approach it, and then you see it, but you don't necessarily see it at the same in the, you know, in your peripheral vision while you're looking at the objects themselves. Also, these tables are the multi-user. So that means that, you know, lots of... First of all, there's the benefit of having lots of people being interacted at the one time and share their interactions. So people can kind of interact in parallel. They can kind of interact together in the case of the kind of painting area at the end of the table where people kind of draw things together. People can do high information things, like you can be reading text or looking at video, and other people can be squashing ants or, you know, moving their hands through the sands. Great for families, great for parents with their children, creating kind of opportunities where family groups can kind of bundle together but be doing kind of working in parallel rather than all on the one thing. So the multi-userness is kind of interesting as well. It raises a lot of issues about negotiation and consent and how you kind of arrange yourselves around the table. And we could kind of, I mean, it's sort of, I guess, in the early days of these tables, we don't really know yet how far to push this kind of idea of, you know, how to create a space where everybody has a happy time, but as long as your happy time doesn't impinge on my happy time, then we're all going to have a happy time. But it's sort of a something that we can push more, where, you know, you give more control to individuals perhaps, and they can kind of, you know, take over the table in certain ways. So it might be a point to think of in future. But also, what the previous examples had that make this current example different from those previous examples is the fact that this is multi-touch. So individuals' hand movements, individuals' fingers, just like the iPad and like the iPhone, are tracked individually, and at a label, that sort of opens up this whole range of gestures that people can use to move media around. You know, they can... You're familiar with the pinch and the zoom and the rotate and the pushing things away and, you know, dragging and offering things with sort of velocity. So that instead of it's just being a point and click from the traditional touchscreen, the way that, you know, feels kind of like a contained or an ordered experience when it's all point and click. Here it's a little bit more free form, and people are able to have some sort of agency over the content, and especially with those paintings in this case, where you can kind of zoom them up to as big as you want them, and zoom them down again and put them away. That kind of stuff that sort of gives you a totally different experience, and when coupled with the looking at the paintings, you see the paintings, the actual object, but it's definitely look and don't touch. Whereas over here, you can kind of look and peer into different details, and that's certainly a fantastic augmentation of the or an interplay between the authentic object and the virtual object. So just talking through the process of how we came about this, this project arrived, Nikki Maher approached us early on in, was it the beginning of last year, where they had this kind of idea for a table, and they wanted to use the map And that was about as kind of much as we had at that point. I wanted to use this Canning map and kind of annotate it or populate it with a whole lot of stories and paintings and text objects. It naturally happened that, you know, the map is fantastic for the table orientation. We're used to looking down onto maps and, you know, sharing a map on a table and all looking from different directions. So it kind of made a natural fit with the interactive table. The other parameter that kind of decided a whole lot of design things was the fact that they wanted this exhibition to travel. And so we normally would have naturally kind of fallen into the other idea of those earlier examples I showed, where it was all projected down onto a hard tabletop, using projectors and using cameras to pick up the touches of visitors or the hand positions of visitors. All of those examples, early examples I showed, use projectors and infrared enabled cameras. It's great for that kind of big, spectacular, sort of theatrical look, but not so good for all those gestures, those multi-touch gestures I've mentioned. But also not so good to travel. You know, it's a bit of quite a lot of hardware in the ceiling and a lot of delicate calibration that's required. And so for this thing to travel to in 6 months' time, it moves off to Perth, and then perhaps another 6 months after that it moves to, I don't know where it goes, China. To kind of rebuild that rig each time would be, you know, a bit of a pain. So we started to look around for these technologies that might enable travel. So this particular unit suddenly came on the market, even though it was a little bit experimental when we were first looking at it. I think the only ones were owned by CSIRO in Australia, and, you know, they were kind of, you know, in this factory in Finland making them one at a time. But now, luckily, we kind of backed, I hope we backed the right horse, and that the burgeoning company and the, you know, sending these things all over the world now. But it's basically that whole projection device. It doesn't use a projector in it, but it's a like an LCD screen. But that whole kind of rig is kind of packed into one box. So you can kind of fit all these boxes together, and each one has individual calibration. And it basically means that the extremely high resolution, especially compared to those projectors, fantastic for text, fantastic for videos and still images. And the fine detail that was in the map that I don't think we could have achieved with projectors, we're able to achieve with this particular technology. So here's some early visualizations where we quite soon on we thought that this shape emerged, an arrangement of these cells or these screens along the shape of the Canning stock route, and that the map itself obviously has a lot of blank space that Alfred Canning thought was blank, but we now know shouldn't be blank. But it enables us to kind of populate the whole area with that's where the content could naturally sit. So one of the first things we always do is once we've kind of established the parameters of our design, we do it like a paper mock-up. This is just on foam core. We got measured up the map and got it all printed, just to give a sense of what it feels like to walk around the place and just to see what it feels like in terms of space, whether one person can... I'm not sure I can point, can I? But it soon emerged that... found that these kind of angles within the... these little sort of niches within the screen array emerged, and realised that they'd be great sort of nooks for people to kind of stand at, and small groups or individuals could stand at different sized ones. And that kind of natural sort of tessellation, I guess, of the screen array allowed for, I don't know, it feels like a sort of more broken up and an interesting shape than it would be if it was just a big long bar. So as we kind of started to work up the design, one of the key things we thought about was just the not only the volume of content that Nikki has already described and enumerated, but we thought that because of the size of this thing, you know, none of us had ever really seen an 8-metre long interactive before, and we didn't know how people would respond to it. And we thought that fatigue would be a big issue, especially given the complexity of the rest of the exhibition anyway. By the time you arrive at this, you know, you've probably had enough. So to kind of expect visitors to work their way along from one end to the other, it was a bit of an ask. So we started to think about ways of trying to introduce variety into the experience so that people kind of move along these screens and see something different at each place. So this early design was just to kind of almost like a wireframe, just to throw in some ideas about how you could look at things in a variety of ways. But early on we knew that we wanted to have this kind of satellite viewer and ways of showing video, ways of showing text, ways of showing chaptered stories. We had to think also about audio, the clash of audio from multiple sites with these sort of multi-user displays. Audio is a big issue. But ultimately, you know, we kind of thought we'd wing it, see what happens, and see what happened. And in the final result, it seems to be okay that people can kind of, because they have control over their individual video program, they can rewind and fast forward and do those sorts of things. Competing audio sources doesn't seem to be as much of an issue as we originally imagined. But sort of moving on, yeah, we started to think of different ways of populating this content, but also we were kind of thinking that, you know, one screen had to be about, this early version kind of shows like a thematic breakup of the content. We thought the first screen might be about, you know, conflict. The next one might be about droving. The next one might be about, you know, painting techniques. So we were kind of thinking of a thematic breakup of the content. And the idea there was that you would kind of move through more regularly than if you just saw a massive, you know, bunch of icons on screen and you didn't quite know what you were getting until you touched them. So this is just another developed design. One of the things we kind of had to work out also was this business. Because these screens, you can reach across them and touch a button on the other side, we thought that how do you orient the content when it gets touched from the other side? And, you know, we had to think about ways of kind of launching content from different sides of the screen. And our initial ideas turned out to be stupid ones, so we moved on from those. During the whole process, we were kind of, there's a bit of a dance going on between the content team and the design team about, we were kind of waiting for content, they were waiting for design. Because this massive amount of content had been gathered, it could have been cut up and carved up in, you know, a myriad of ways. So I think they were kind of, Nikki and Monique LaFontaine were kind of waiting to see the design so that they could go and chop bits off and put it into the design, and we were kind of waiting to see what the overall picture of the content was. So there was a bit of back and forth between us, just trying to work out, and we had a few goes at, you know, we'll do the content this way, and they went off and kind of managed it, and then we said, oh, that didn't work. So yes, it was an interesting time. But I think ultimately, yeah, you know, once we kind of got to see it and got to understand it, we started soon then to realise the best way to do this was to, I mean, the content had to be geographically located. I think that was so this idea of kind of breaking the screens up into themes or breaking the screens up into, you know, any other form didn't work. I mean, it all had to be based on the map, and that story had to exist on the map, that painting had to exist on the map in its location. So the one thing that we all feared, well, certainly I feared, was, you know, this kind of confetti of dots over the entire map turned out to be the best solution. And I think ultimately, you know, it's kind of works out, or it's worked well, because people do just make their way around and are always kind of continually brought back to place and to the country. I don't know why I included that one. This is just a final little bit of video, and we'll wrap up shortly. But a lot of some of those ideas that we had about, there's a lot of sort of quite not didactic content, but there's a lot of text, there's a lot of images. But also we had to have a lot of leavening of fun in there, and kind of respite from the story and the kind of non-fiction side. So the 3D animals, the sand, the ants, all of these different aspects kind of try to give you a sense of other things or, you know, something else to do as well, and then before making another launch on the content. So we might end it there, and then we'll throw over to Carol and take your questions later. Thank you.
Oh, well, thank you, Michael. That was fabulous. And really, I realise now I've popped in there a couple of times and I've had a little play, but I really have to go back because there's all sorts of things there that I hadn't found yet. And that's one of the great things about an attractor that will keep people coming back to it. And I can see, you know, the potential for learning with mum, with dad, with grandpa, showing each other and that social environment of learning together, and it looks fantastic. I must say, I liked doing the sand drawing. I just thought that suited me, but that probably there's all sorts of potential in there. So thank you very much for that. And I was also reminded as part of my life as an exhibition developer that there is no such thing as an easy development, and that's because it's such a complex business. And so I wasn't surprised to hear that it went back and forward and back and forward, and there were lots of different ideas and themes, because that's how things happen. And the reality is you came back to the map, which underpins all of what this exhibition was about in the beginning. And as you say, that sense of place and that geography was probably the right place to be at. I can imagine, having watched visitors access all sorts of information and programs and exhibitions, that if you'd have expected them to start at one end and move across, they wouldn't have done that anyway. So now that they can dip in at any point and get a snapshot via a geographical space is probably a great way to work. So, great. I'm really looking forward to our conversation now. So thank you for that, Michael. Now, I did say that Tikka was going to talk to us. Tikka's going to join us on the couch and weave through some of her role, which, of course, she's the multimedia and web person here at the National Museum. So you can imagine that she had a critical part in all of this as the project came together. So I think now what we'd like to do is thank Michael very much for your entertainment, and I think we're going to move up here to our seats, where I'm hoping that you've got a number of good questions stored up to tease out some of the issues around this particular project, but also about the potential of multimedia in the museum and what we're going to talk about. So thank you. So here we are on the couch. You remember Michael, Nikki, Tikka, and roving microphones over here and here, I think. So just remembering, it is being filmed for later use, so when you want to ask a question, hand up, identify who you are. If you've got a particular person you're putting your question to, identify which one of these people, or it may be a general kind of question for discussion, and make sure you speak into the microphone. So I guess I could start it by saying, like I said, I am a visitor junkie, really, and I think that the potential of multimedia in the museum looks very exciting. So having seen just a glimpse of what this is all about, you know, would we like to explore how that's going to work for us and where is that potential? So, Michael, do you want to kind of start leading us that way? I mean, you've dibbled into the potential. But
sure. I guess the potential for me in terms of these sorts of experiences is this notion of interactivity and breaking beyond just the traditional sort of form of the screen or the cinema screen, and the kind of relationship between media and the object, the collection object. I think they're the kind of key things that museums do really well. They enable some of these experiences now are kind of different enough from what you can do at home. I think it's an important thing that you don't do stuff on a small screen that you can kind of do over the web within exhibitions I'm talking about, or that you kind of a cinematic experience. I think those sorts of things are best for
best kept for those sorts of media, because the budgets aren't there in museums. But what you do have are these fantastic objects and this kind of collection between, or connection between the collection object and the media is where the media becomes really rich. At the War Memorial, we did early on a for the Striking by Night, using the G for George Lancaster. The media we produced, you know, if you just watch that by yourself, you just think it was terrible, Mickey Mouse and hopeless, but then you see it in connection with the object itself and it suddenly comes to life. The kind of authenticity of the objects is obviously the thing that interests me. But just returning to the point about interactivity, that also seems to be the kind of big thing that museums can offer as well. These spaces that are different enough from anything you can do at home. And people just love it.
They do indeed. And, yes, another observation is that the old, I guess the old days of didactic panels and objects in glass cases is kind of gone. The young person today particularly expects some kind of interactive experience when they visit us.
Question? Oh, up the back first.
Backwards. The exhibition, the virtual exhibition is absolutely beautiful. And I'm wondering, once the exhibition is over, can it be migrated back to then the desktop? What is the potential for that, for people to do a virtual exhibition at home, given that you've done this beautiful thing for people who come?
Did you want that?
We're certainly thinking about that. As you can see from the enormity of the project, we really didn't put that to one side, but that would certainly be one of the next steps, because I agree with you, it's wonderful and we should be able to migrate it into the next space.
Well, I certainly hope so. It'll be great. Down the front here.
Hello, I'm Jackie Troy from the University of Canberra. This is a wonderful exhibition in terms of teaching on a range of levels about the Western Desert, its peoples, its history, visual art, and also teaching about how to put together good teaching materials. I love your online education kit, and I like the hard copy version too. This is kind of the hard copy version of your... if you can make that connection, because it's so virtual. But I'd love to see it somehow, this is perhaps for you, Tika, realised as an online web-enabled resource. Is that a possibility? Can you migrate your tables into cyberspace so that you can download some component of it?
Certainly we can migrate the content and some of the interactivity, but, you know, even though... multi-touch screens are being released onto the home market. I think that aspect of it, having 10 screens, I mean, that clearly we can't do so easily. But yes, absolutely.
What I was particularly thinking of, now most classrooms have interactive whiteboards, and I see them less used in high schools, unfortunately. But this is a kind of exhibition and basic e-media type display that would work at, I think, at any level of schooling, at particularly aspects of it.
Hello.
Tom Worthington from the Australian National University. The last two speakers asked the same question I was going to ask.
That's obviously the question of the day.
So I'll try to ask a slightly different question. How do you communicate the different nature of this to the people who might come to it? Because I just came expecting a normal exhibition and was remarkably impressed when I got here. But what it was not clearly communicated, and I was expecting a few old stock whips and things hanging up. I just wonder if hardly anybody's going to come because they won't realise what's in there. How do you communicate the different nature of this to the potential audience? And the last question is, where do you buy these screens? Because my colleagues in the Defence Department would want to buy them.
Yeah, they've probably already got them.
No, they don't.
Did you want to answer?
We almost need a person from the marketing department of the National Museum. Tika, do you want to take it?
Well,
Yes, I suppose. I'm interested. So you thought it was going to be white fella history, basically, stock whips and whatever, because it was the Canning stock route part of the title that grabbed your imagination rather than you are a Kuju. So that didn't mean anything to you. Yes. Well, that's interesting. We've certainly been making an effort to communicate that it is the Indigenous story and that it's told through paintings and, you know.
I'd just add to that, being in the museum sector, and I'd heard this exhibition was in development for quite a long time, and I, like you, just grabbed onto the Canning stock route part of it. And I came on the first Saturday it opened after the Thursday night opening and was absolutely blown away by it. And the first thing I said to some of my colleagues back at work on the Monday was, I'm not sure that people know what they're going to see. And I don't know whether they're going to get that message out. So I'm with you a bit. I think the National Museum knows that and will, you know, will probably vary their messages they're getting out there. I mean, the interactive part of it isn't obvious to anybody.
No.
And it is quite nice when you happen upon it because you discover it. And that's one of the nice things about museum visits. We know that the people that come expecting something and then you surpass their expectations is even greater. But the risk is, of course, that a whole lot of people out there mightn't know what they're going to miss. And this is where word of mouth becomes your greatest seller. And I'm quite sure that in the next month, and I'm already hearing it around town, that the word is going to get out there that this is a fabulous exhibition. But you're right.
Yeah,
I think I expected more about a stock route and less about contemporary Indigenous art. And I certainly didn't expect, although I knew the interactive was happening, I didn't expect the kind of level and complexity of that interactive.
That's really helpful. We'll certainly feed it back.
I'm sure Rachel will talk to the marketing people. Where's the next question coming from? Over here.
Hi. I'm Richard Lamond. I'm an information researcher. But I was wondering, when you're talking about interactivity, has the notion of our mobile interactivity ever come into the discussion? We all carry interactive machines in our pocket, but we talk about foreign interactive machines, the whiteboards and stuff.
So your question is, could we integrate kind of mobiles and that sort of technology into
yes.
the broader experience? I guess, I mean, I'm probably a little bit quite old-fashioned, but I mean, I love going to places where you can get something that you can't get anywhere else, and it's that sort of destination.
Well, that's what I was talking about. You can get headphones when you go to the library.
Yeah,
but it's very limited.
But it's that sort of it becomes a destination. It becomes something to go to in the flesh with your physical person.
Oh, I wasn't separating them. I was talking about combining them.
Using it as a tool in the space.
Within the space, mm-hmm. Yeah. I guess there are ways of interacting. You know, we often get asked to, create programs where you can, you know, Bluetooth in and get the media off the device and onto your hand device to take away. But, you know, when you start to go through the steps required to do that for a multitude of phones, it becomes really difficult. But, you know, that's not to say it doesn't happen elsewhere in the world. But, yeah, it's not something we kind of look at. We sort of like to kind of have this relationship with objects, media, kind of directly rather than sort of augmented through yet another device. But still interesting.
There's certainly some museums that are using a variety of technology and tools.
And especially GPS sort of, interpretations of heritage locations. You know, that's definitely...
Hello.
Where are we next? Up the back.
Hi, Carol.
I can't see who you are.
It's Stephanie from the War Memorial.
Oh, nice to see you, Stephanie.
Hi, everybody. I've got a couple of questions, one for Nikki and one for Michael, if I might. Nikki, you said that you went up without a brief, and I'm sure we've all had that experience of, you know, finding ourselves in the deep end but having fun at the same time. But you also said you had to abandon your expectations, and I just wondered if you could tease that out a little bit more, maybe what did you expect, or, you know, what did you find yourself abandoning along the way?
Well, I as a filmmaker, I really have to frame what I'm doing and at least go out there with an idea and also brief my crew. So I couldn't do that. And basically, I felt that It's very hard because I knew that at the end of it they would look at me and say, well, can you make a film out of this? And I would say, I would have to be able to say, yes, I can. And so when I started the project, I made a list of all the things that we could shoot and that could potentially become worked into some sort of story, which is the painting camps, the landscape, the bush tucker and hunt, you know, any, all the things that I felt that we would, because I had been into the desert a few times already, I knew the sort of things that we could film, and also think I needed to have drama as well. So I had to make sure that everyone who was at all able to carry a camera carried a camera so that we could film any interesting and exciting moments, because these don't happen very often, as we all know, and you need to be in the right place at the right time. I thought that I was going to make a film at the end of it. I didn't expect the project to expand the way it has. So we actually went into it with without any parameters of where and how the Canning Stock Group project was going to evolve into. Does that answer your question?
The process as well. So that's fantastic. And I wonder if I could be really greedy and ask Michael my question as well. You were talking about the layout of the tables and the fact that people are at a different kind of surface and they're standing together and they're working in a different way. The implication is that they're learning in a different way as well? Is this, I heard something recently about a theory where people are, if they're moving at the same time that they're learning, that they learn in a different way. And is this the way that museums are going?
Yeah, I guess there's a range of responses to that, because I think being the father of now a 13-year-old boy, he definitely learns in a different way than my 11-year-old girl. And this kind of parallel play that they always talk about in, you know, childhood, kids doing things together, kids doing things separately but together is fascinating. And as you watch people kind of working with the table, that's kind of what happens, is people are, you know, touching base every now and then with their partner but back doing their thing. So it's kind of it's a shared experience, but they're learning or getting what they want to do when they've had enough. They might have read a text story, they close that up for a while and go off and do something else, maybe a bit more restful or low information for a while. The kind of niches or those little sort of areas around the table happened just due to the geometry of the boxes fitting into the way that Stock Route was laid out. But they kind of just happily created these little places for groups and or individuals to gather. And I don't think there's certainly no intent behind that would happen, but, you know, people have just kind of moved in and populated them.
There seems to be a viral learning thing going on, which I think is really exciting, because you can see people will discover something, like, especially that you can squash ants, but other things as well. And you can see it ripple down the table when somebody watches one person do it and then they try it and it sort of moves its way down. And I think that's really interesting, because it's a different way of sharing, and it's very informal learning, but it starts to spark things, or somebody opens up one of the big paintings that you can stretch around and then somebody else does it. And it's very interesting. I don't know exactly what it means, but it's really interesting to observe this ripple effect across a large shared space, as opposed to people at even fairly large screens where they're, you know, there's only one driver. So.
Hello, it's Louise Hamby here from ANU. I teach in Museums and Collections program, and I want to get back to the future that we were talking about before. And it seems to me from listening to your discussions, and particularly in relation to the last question about to Nikki, about what your brief was and what you were anticipating doing, it seems that everything has gone to a kind of short and punchy kind of information level. And I was very interested when Nikki said she thought she was going to be making a film. And I'd like to kind of go back to that because I think it's brilliant, the interactive table, but there's a part of me that wants to have a bigger picture. Like, I would love to have seen a film about the whole project, you know, an actual film that lasted more than 3 minutes. I think there is definitely a place for the short and punchy, and it gets people in, draws them in. But is there no future left for the kind of bigger picture in interactives and museums? And whoever wishes to answer that question, I'll be happy with.
I would think there's a place for everything. I think the wonderful thing about having content that this, like what this project has, is that we are in fact in production with a long version of behind the scenes film about how this project evolved. But also during our many debates about content, Monique LaFontaine, who's the content manager and curator, and I spent many months debating how to do these stories and how to fit them into the interactive. And me as filmmaker was always trying to, like, put more of the film into it and make it a story, because I keep thinking, we've got to have a story. And in the end, it was boiled down to we realized that in order for them each piece to stand alone, which it had to do because you couldn't ask people to walk from one end to the other end, we had to develop ideas where each film, each story, you know, could stand alone, but also have relationship with the rest of the interactive and also relationship with the exhibition itself. So we ended up coming up with, after a lot of arguing, chaptered stories, where each one, where there would be, if you do look at the signature piece, the chaptered stories of maybe eight stories of 2 to 3 minutes, you can string them together and they'd actually make a longer film. And so if you could be bothered to go through all of them, you'll see that there are longer versions within the signature piece. But and perhaps one day we will put them, we have strung them together, and it does work, you know, if you put all the chaptered ones together. But each chapter works on its own as well. So I think we also developed a scenario where we could, each film will stand alone, but also was linked in the chain with other films, and you could see it. So maybe it's just a different way of looking at film.
There's also I don't know if you noticed the theaterette when you were in there. That was where we did have some longer form films, the very large round orange space. So we tried to mix up both having, what, the longest one is 10 minutes, is it? About eight. So there's a, you know, 3 10-minute films so that you can actually sit and get more of a narrative. So, you know, we were conscious that to ask people to stand for 10 or 15 minutes is a big ask in an exhibition.
In terms of the longer 10-minute films versus the interactive, have you observed, do more people watch the 10-minute films, or do more people actually are involved with the table interactives?
I don't know about more and less. I think, they're different experiences and people would do both. So in going through an exhibition, certainly I love the moments when I can just sit down and, you know, just sit and be with some content, and then I'll get up and become active again. So I think in watching people, I've noticed that they go in and out of the space, but I don't know if they're, you know, some people probably prefer one way of absorbing content and others prefer other.
So it's a big exhibition design issue as well, where you're thinking about visitor circulation and, you know, hold points where people kind of come in. I personally don't like going to a place and seeing a half-hour movie where, especially if I come in at minute 15, and you see the last half and then you sit there and watch the first half. Places like these theatrettes, are fantastic for that, because you can say, session time, 3:15, be there at the beginning and we'll watch a half-hour movie. Whereas you put those on the exhibition floor and they become either choke points where, you know, a great audience comes in and leaves all at once, or you get this business of looping video and, you know, you see the end before you see the beginning. So it's sort of kind of hard, but I kind of come back to that point of sort of media for its place. And, you know, the theatreettes like this are probably great places for the half-hour intense piece. But you're right, I mean, we generally now tend to make things kind of broad but shallow rather than sort of deep. And that's the way that, you know, those information kiosks that we used to design used to kind of have, you know, 19 levels to them and, you know, 33 different things because the hardware was expensive and you kind of cram all sorts of stuff in there. But that would be a very kind of detailed and deep experience. But now it's kind of much more about having lots of screens and having shorter experiences so that more people can kind of access them and, you know, all have an interactive experience at the same time.
It'll be interesting to see, I'm sure, you know, towards the end of this exhibition where there's some evaluation about how visitors do access the space. I'm sure people will be tracking and following and measuring time, you know, what's the average length of stay and how long do people dip in and out, because we people love that, because then we can see it and translate it for the next exhibition development.
We people hate that. We have the sheet of paper that says, you know, average length of time spent in exhibition, 14 seconds, or, you know, viewing this piece of media, 23 seconds.
Yes, I know. Yes.
Hello, Susanna Churchill, I work here. I was just wondering, because I'm in the education section, and when I'm in there, I'm usually with children, and of course they're all flocking around there. But I was wondering how it is getting in the older generation when they come in with families. I've noticed with the vertical screens, the parents and the grandparents stand back and watch all these junior geniuses interacting with the computer. And is this a good way of getting the older people to come in and share it with them across that table, because it's a less threatening format for them?
I'll have a go. what I find with the table surfaces, there used to be, I feel, a fear. Older people tended to have a fear that with a touchscreen they'd break something or press the wrong button. Whereas now I feel like that sort of sense of play and discovery is so kind of embedded in it that people don't feel like they're going to break it. At least they're going to kind of have a go and see what happens. But there's no sort of fear, and, you know, there seems to be just a bit more openness to that kind of media rather than, you know, what's this thing expecting of me? And also somehow because you don't have a crowd of people behind you watching you touching a touchscreen, you know, you're in there amongst everybody else and learning at the same time. It feels like there's just a bit more kind of openness towards it.
It would be interesting to see if there's any follow-up about whether people are less threatened by computers as a result of that, and doing a longitudinal study of elder people's approach to computers as a result.
Yeah,
definitely. Well, I was in there this morning and there were no young people around the table, only about six older men and women, and they were tentatively touching it, but gradually they started to show each other what they were discovering on the table, and so they started getting more and more adventurous as it went on, and after about 10 minutes they were all over the table. So I think that, as Tikka said, that there is something about this particular piece that invites people to learn how to use it, because it has on the surface a lot of fun things that children can come in and start doing. But underneath that, the older people could come along and realise that there's real genuine content underneath the fun stuff. And then they can start exploring that. And so the older generation could show the younger generation that, and the younger generation can show the older generation how to explore. So I think it's going to be interesting to see how it does teach, you know, different. I think there's a two-way street there that could happen.
I think one of the most gorgeous moments that I observed was when the communities came the night before we launched it, and there were kids running around with older people in wheelchairs, and the kids were pushing things, and the older people were learning and laughing, and it was the most amazing ebb and flow of information, including I was watching one older person draw in the sand and do sand teaching with a younger person. It was quite extraordinary.
Next.
Hello. Sorry. Linda Roberts from ACT Heritage, congratulations on a wonderful exhibition. I just have a question, and perhaps you might see it as looking backwards rather than forwards. Is there still any room for tour guides or face-to-face people? Or perhaps, Nikki, you've already mentioned that things do complement each other, but in this exhibition, do you have any guides or helpers helping people along?
We haven't really got anybody on the panel who's from the National Museum front of house.
But we do. Well, I mean, we do have guides. And
yes, observation. Yes. Is there a people right?
Yes, we do have our visitor services people, and they've reported back to us that they find particularly the interactive a really good talking point, and that it's a place from which they launch off into other things. But absolutely, yes, people are vital, I think. Yeah.
I was just wondering, as a tourist destination, are there any plans to make the resources more available to people who don't speak English as their primary language?
Yes.
What do they involve?
We're hoping to be able to translate a lot more of our material, and clearly digital media makes that easier than printed material. But it's certainly, you know, very high on our list. Also, our visitor services people speak many, many languages, so our tours are available in multiple languages.
I was going to ask two questions. One is the wonderful tables distracting from the other part of the exhibition. Is it putting that in the shade? And second, well, maybe you answer that one first.
I'll answer that. I don't think at all. In fact, we were disappointed when the paintings were lit for the first time. You know, we were kind of working with work lights on, and, you know, we'd have our table sort of magnificently glowing. And then as soon as the lights came down and the paintings were lit properly, we were just thought, oh, gee, we may as well give up. The paintings just look so fantastic, and as soon as you walk in, you know what the show's about. You just see that magnificent curve down the left-hand side of all the work, and, you know, I don't think the screens, they're still screens, you know, it's still kind of that glossy television kind of look, whereas you see the sort of richness of the paintings, and I think they, you know, they complement each other, but the paintings win.
The other question was, how much of this show or exhibition is going back to the people it came from, and how?
Well, the paintings were purchased by the National Museum as a collection, and with that collection, they'll also get all our research and the film and the photographs, but all that will be also duplicated and get given back to the 10 art centres, all the communities that were involved. So basically everything. Everyone will... the museum will hold it as a repository, and the art centres will be able to use... The young people will be able to use it in the future, the emerging filmmakers or whoever needs to see it. You know, old people really love looking at any sort of pictures, film about themselves. So I think it's going to be a rich resource for them. Also, Form worked very hard to negotiate copyright to remain with the artists. So there's certain protocols, I think, with the museum that have been established with this project that we hope will become the norm in the future for Indigenous projects anyway.
Yeah. And I'd like to add that the communities specifically selected the National Museum to hold the collection because they wanted it to be here and they wanted it to be available to the nation rather than locating it in any number of other museums. And one of the expectations is that we'll make it available online so that everybody will be able to access as much of the material as possible, whenever, from wherever, into the future. So I think to pick up the theme of the future of museums, that is one way that we're going. On the one hand, there's the physical embodied experience in a museum, and secondly, I think there's increasingly an expectation that we all make our collections and all of the interpretive material available to everyone, not only in Australia but worldwide. And the communities were certainly aware of the worldwide reach of their story and of their paintings and of their history.
Just next question in the middle there.
Before I hand it on, I would give a big plug for a narrative too. Maybe I'm that generation, but I'd love to see a half hour or a little longer narrative to string it all together. Mm. You know, that these beads, these jewels on a necklace.
Yeah. Em Blaney from Questacon. I've got more of a practical question for Michael. Did it take you a while to settle on using those particular screens, and how are you finding them for reliability and durability?
Is it week six? No, I think we settled on them because they were the only ones that, first of all, there are LCD foil rather than a projector in them. So we thought straight away that there's no lamp changes, no heat issues, or not as many heat issues. And they have a thin mullion around the edge, so you can fit them together and almost kind of pretend that they don't have a frame. So competing things like the Microsoft Surface and those sorts of products have a kind of thicker edge, so you put them together and they kind of look a little bit gooby. So that's the reason we went with those ones. And as it turns out, I guess there are other products on the market now, but still none with that sort of thin frame to them. And it all came out of University of Helsinki in Finland, all the research. So the university or the researchers within the university developed this company that kind of now supports them and ships them all over the world. So I feel like it's kind of, because it's an LED light source as well, they're meant to live for 50,000 hours without, needing to change the lamp. So we'll see. That's all we can do. And at the bleeding edge, that's all you can...
So far, so good.
All you can do.
Yeah. Next questions? Is there a microphone up the back?
Thank you. Len Glasser, I'm a filmmaker. I'm interested in a little bit, if you're able to talk about maybe a bit of the financial structure of how this works, the business structure of relating so many people, so many organizations, so many people that have such intense connection and involvement with various pieces of this, I guess you call it a collection, yet it's a production. And I've heard discussion about form involved with the museum coming on board. But there's a lot of talk today, mentions of things that are still going to happen with the project, the potential for international translation, repatriation of the original work, presentations back, copies, and so forth. Who is the leader? Who is fearless leader, if I might ask, in a sense? And therefore, who is channeled and how is the channeling for the various aspects and resources come together, if that can be done briefly and in public?
Good luck.
Well, there is a bit of jockeying for position in that regard. Funding happened as we needed the money, as ideas came up and as the project moved forward, the form went out and looked around at who could fund it. We were initially funded by BHP, who have been very generous. They had first option for the collection, but they deferred to the museum, which was very big of them, actually. Western Australia does have a lot of money to put into things like this, and we have been funded to return the material back to the communities. The mentor program was also well funded by the Department of Arts and Culture. They're very interested in sustainable living for the young people back in the community, not having them come out into our world, but being able to get their skills up outside and go back and use them back in their community, which is what has happened with this project. My four mentorees, they live in their communities. They're very adept at travelling, and you know they can come out and learn and go back and take it back, but they all will stay within the community. So that was well funded. The signature piece was actually we did a big pitch to the major fund in WA, and they loved the idea. As long as it gets shown in Western Australia, which, as you know, there's certain obligations within each piece of funding that we got that we still need to disperse. But basically, it was a project that appealed to people's imagination. And as it grew, the enthusiasm for it seemed to grow as well. And we have been pretty lucky with being able to finance the various portions of it. It wasn't done by one person. It was done by a lot of very many different funding bodies.
And in terms of the future, it's still very much a partnership between the National Museum and FORM. FORM took the initiative in terms of the project, bringing the people together, working with the art centres, working with the people in WA. And the National Museum has taken the leadership role in the exhibition itself, in producing the multimedia, working with FORM and with Lightwell. And we'll also take the initiative into the future in terms of caring for the collection and making sure that it's available as it needs to be available. We don't do all that many partnerships with non-government bodies, and that was pretty interesting to try to manage all of the various requirements that you have as a government body with what we perceived as being the amazing freedom that a non-profit organization has to, you know, say, for example, oh, we'd really like this. Let's find somebody to give us money. You know, we're not able to operate that freely. And however, we also had in place a fantastic organization and institution with, you know, lots of people that we can bring together to do different things. And as a partnership, I think it worked really well overall. And that we were incredibly complementary, and that, you know, our various strengths worked together really well, and then we worked very hard at collaborating and communicating effectively with each other because we had very, very different ways of doing things. I don't know. It could be one model, I think. I think that there's some incredible strengths in working with different kinds of organizations, and that the depth of the exhibition is a testament to that, because it was developed curatorially so in collaboration with the communities, which is something that we wouldn't normally have either the time or the energy or the resources to do in such great depth. You know, of course we collaborate with many, many people when we're developing exhibitions, but I think FORM did that differently and, you know, in a way that it would have been difficult for us. But bringing the two together, you know, I think works really well. So I would hope that we'd be doing more partnerships like this.
Where's our next question? Up the back, over there.
Hello, I'm Michelle, and I'm at home. I do home duties, and I have two kids that are 11 and 15. I hadn't actually realised about the tables before I came in this time, and my 11-year-old just refused to come. Now I can go home and tell him. I actually worked up the courage to go over to them today, and then I realised what they're about, and I can go home and tell him that there are these fantastic tables, and that will get him in to see this show. I have a couple of questions. One is to Nikki. I imagine, you know, now that you have this fantastic technology, I mean, I've just never seen anything quite like it before, but that now you could put so much into an exhibition in terms of filming that you no longer have to think in terms of, oh, I have to throw something away because I haven't got enough room in the in this exhibition. So has the ability to put so much into the exhibition now with this technology meant that your reasons for why you might keep something or why you might throw something away or not put it in an exhibition, have they changed? And my other question to everyone on the panel is, I imagine it makes you think that there must be a whole lot of things, projects out there that you can do now that maybe a few years ago you couldn't really even think of doing because the amount of information that you would need to put into the exhibition would be so great. But now you maybe can think of doing things you couldn't do before. And what would you maybe, would each of you maybe have a favourite project that you might like to do resulting from now being able to use this technology?
Well, it's an interesting question because, first of all, this project is unusual because of the amount of time and resources that went into it, enabled us to have this amazing range of content. You couldn't normally go out and collect this sort of content with a normal project. It needed you know, a team of 14 dedicated people over 3 years to bring this to fruition. So I think it would be difficult to actually repeat this again on this scale. But having said that, as I'm watching this project evolve, it's not just that it's an exhibition now. You know, the future possibilities for the material is immense. I'm very proud to say for the first time in my career, I nearly used every frame that I had to, you know, for the signature piece. And I would be searching through it all the time thinking, well, how can, you know, I need this to put there and to illustrate this. And I managed to actually use everything. And that was very satisfying for someone whose idea of material in making a film is 1 to 100. So there are huge possibilities, I think. I mean, now we can go out and make a making-of film, and I can give the material to the emerging filmmakers, and they can use it to make their own little films and do whatever they want. And they can have new perspectives, new ideas, new stories come out of it. What I have learned is that you can take any material that's shot and give it to 10 people, and they'll come out with different stories. So in that way, maybe this is a new way of using content and material so that we're not thinking of it in a linear fashion, that it can only be used for one thing and then you throw it away. I mean, granted, the material in this project, most of it was really, you know, a filmmaker's dream because it's all so beautiful. But, you know, I see the possibilities for it are enormous. You know, as an archive, as a library, as returning to country and being used by the community. So it's in that way, it's I think it's earning its keep really, for the amount of time and resources that have gone into it. But whether it changes my idea of how I would do it in the future, I shudder to think. To tell you the truth, it was hard.
But also, I think I would shudder as well if you said that you were going to change your way of doing things, because things still have to be edited. You still have to have that kind of capacity. You can't just give all the outtakes to somebody and to the visitor and say, you know, knock yourself out. Because, you know, 2 or 3 hours more of finally edited footage, you need to tell people what you think is important. And so, you know, we all know the experience of the World Wide Web. So you kind of need to, you know, those skills of editing and shaping the content and creating these little islands of interest, still valuable. But the fact that you can kind of have this long tail of media within those areas, that's of tremendous interest because, you know, if you've got a particular focus on, you want to find everything about droving, you know, yes, here's half an hour of film for you about that. So it's that sort of stuff. You've still got to tell them, though, it's about droving.
And visitors do have a capacity. You know, there's only so much time that people are prepared to delve into information. And that's one of the tricks of putting together an exhibition which will engage the visitor. So not everybody will want to stay and watch, you know, every single piece of every bit of information that was collected along the way. And the role of the curator, the producer, the designer and all of those people that come together is to float the really good stories to the top, make it engaging and find the right communication method to engage that. So, yeah, I think there's potential there for archiving and there's all, and the World Wide Web is just, you know, out there now, so people can delve in and find all sorts of support information as well.
I think one of the most exciting possibilities is to encourage users to contribute content to it, and that's one of the things that I don't think it was appropriate for this particular interactive, but that's one of the things that we're all looking at increasingly is figuring out ways of combining our content with the content that visitors bring or contribute, either, you know, when they're here or online, and then feeding that through into an exhibition space. Very complex still to manage that, but it's certainly one of the potentials, I think, of this kind of technology.
Mm. I think we've got about 5 minutes left. Are there a couple more questions out there? One in the middle here.
Peter here. Just a quick follow-up on that one. You said you're thinking of making it available to anyone who wanted to make a film or maybe an internet presentation. Would that be free or would there be charges have to be paid to the whoever owns a copyright on it? Are you saying it's open, Blake? Anyone can take it?
No. I wasn't saying that. I mean, it the communities could use it. That's why. I mean, the material's going back to the 10 communities that we worked with, so they would have the opportunity to make what they would like out of it if they needed to. For instance, my emerging filmmakers, when they make a film, they use a lot of archive footage. Also, they like to have footage of their country, and we've shot all their countries, so they can use, you know, take pieces of that and incorporate it into new films that they want to make. I'm not saying that anyone could use it, because all this material is copyrighted back to the original owners. So it needs to be, permission needs to be sought if anyone needs to use it or wants to use it.
It sounds like a pretty scary thing to try and get that kind of permission.
Have we got another question out there? Oh, sorry, I was looking straight over the top.
It was very moving. That is the most marvellous show. And to come in at the beginning and see the film in the foyer or in the vestibule where the Aboriginal women are taking the earth and throwing it into the river as a gesture of finding their way in a new territory. And that made me think how we're also finding our way. And then we are coming into a space where, with those tables, we are given animations, which are obviously wonderful fun, plus also very serious information. I wondered with the, like, the botanical and the flora and fauna that is so important to the Aboriginal. Did you have a botanist or any scientific sort of input with the 14 people that you selected?
No, unfortunately. We would have loved to have had a botanist. I have all these... One thing I didn't use was all the film of flowers that we had, that we filmed over the stock route. And there were, you know, there's a huge number of flowers and plants out there that we know, well, we really didn't have the time to research and put into the piece. We did think about it. It was on the bottom of the list, flora and fauna. We had a lot of things that we couldn't include because of lack of manpower and research and the amount of time it would take to research. And then in the end, it was just, it came down to we ran out of time as well. There were so many more things we would have liked to have put in it.
That means there's a wonderful opportunity in the future with those tables as well.
Yeah, but go for the sequel.
That's true.
I think we've got the last question up there.
Oh, well, Alison from the National Museum, maybe this is an appropriate time to ask the elephant in the room question. How much did it cost? And is it the case with technology where, you know, a lot of technology is getting cheaper and cheaper, but is it the case where this is becoming more sophisticated technology, so it's actually becoming more expensive?
I can talk about the screens. The screens themselves, I think the museum paid $20,000 a screen, but they're cheaper than that now. So, you know, even in just in 6 months, so they will continue to get cheaper. Do you want to talk about how much you paid on the software?
No. Well, I don't think you can.
You know, development costs, I don't actually know what all of it costs, but secondly, it's the people that are expensive. It's doing the research, it's doing the work, it's bringing it all together, and then what we pay different people to produce things at the end of it is, you know, really just the tip. But yes, the screens cost about that much, and the development was factored into is part of the whole exhibition contract. So the exhibition developers, and I don't know what the total cost of that was, Alison.
Right. That was a good question, wasn't it? Maybe we'd like a final, you know, comment from each of the panel members, and then I think are we ready to kind of start winding up? So Tikka, have you got a final 1 minute for us?
Final 1 minute. Well, I think this has been excellent. Thank you all for coming. I really appreciate your coming and looking at the exhibition and playing with the interactive. It's been an amazing partnership, and I have to say it's been absolutely wonderful working with Nikki and Michael. They're both absolutely wonderful in the creative thinking and energy that they brought to the project, and I can't value them enough, despite not having put a price on their heads. I think the future, in terms of really interesting partnerships between government organizations and a range of different kinds of organizations, including individuals and particularly including creative people, is really going to unfold before us in new and interesting ways. And I think this project is one of those where we were pushing not only the cutting edge of technology and all the issues that brings, because we never really knew exactly how it was going to work because none of us had done something like that before. And I think that will continue to happen as well.
Well, I'd like to thank you for coming too, and just say that it's very interesting for me in particular to get feedback on the exhibition and how and the media within the exhibition, because we did it at such, we really weren't sure of how it would be received, because it's such a big, unwieldy project, and there was never, as I said in the beginning, a brief. So what you see now is you know, 3 years of sculpting something, and you get to the end and you think, well, what is it? You know, what have we done here? And what I think about the media in particular, the signature piece, is that what I've learned from it is that it's a wonderful way of people of different genders and different ages being able to come together and interact with something where I think that really hasn't as yet happened with anything. It's something that's new in that one can show each other different ways of doing things, and because there's so much different types of content within the interactive, it can appeal to a wide range of ages, interests, you know, researchers, people who just want to play, people who really want to get some real content, and you know, while we were doing it, I never really thought about that, but I actually think it works. That it works on that level, on different levels. Thank you. So thank you.
Fantastic. As I said before, just to get some sort of feedback is brilliant. And, you know, it was a brilliant working process as well on the project, because, and it sounds really mundane, but you said it, Nikki, that there was no brief. Sometimes, you know, we get engaged
to do museum work, and there is a brief, and it's tightly written, and this is what you do, and this is the money we've got allowed, you know, we've allowed for it, and go ahead, you know, or tender away, and if you're lucky, you get the tender, and you know, if you're lucky, if you're not, you don't. So the whole process of kind of this particular project was a lot more kind of art based, really. It was like, here's a lump of money, and you know, this is the table that. Or this is the idea that we're all working on, and it was a kind of a working process where it was like sculpting, or I suppose it's like modelling, because we're kind of sticking stuff together, bits of Lego together, and that was fantastically refreshing. And it was, I think it liberated everybody, all the way down to the people that were making the ants. The programmer decided just to, you know, make them squashable on the, you know, on a whim. And, you know, I said, oh, no, nobody's going to like that. Don't put that in. But luckily he ignored me, which gives you some sort of measure of the control I have over my employees. But he, you know, it's that sort of thing, kind of everyone contributes and makes their little bit of the cathedral, and, you know, it's fantastic. But whereas if it's a sort of a strictly kind of briefed and controlled process, often it's a little bit different. So, I don't know, that's probably my soapbox moment. but, yeah, it was a terrific process, and would love to be doing... more of these sorts of things, especially too over such a long period of time.
Well, I'd just like to wind up by saying thank you all for coming this afternoon. I think we've had an enjoyable conversation, and I'd particularly like to thank the National Museum, particularly for that magnificent exhibition out there, and the paintings are definitely the jewels, but there's no doubt that this interactive table is something quite special, and I think the word is getting around, and we love to see different types of people accessing information and enjoying each other's company and engaging in a subject matter that they may not have expected along the way. We seem to have touched on a whole lot of things in our conversation this afternoon. I'd like to thank Rachel and her events team for hosting and putting this on. And, of course, I'm here as the President of Museums Australia, and I know you're all members. Thank you. If you're not, come and see me. We can always join you up. But it's great to have these kind of professional development discussions, and we're happy to be a partner with the National Museum today. And I think we're having afternoon tea down there, and maybe some of us can continue this conversation, because there's always more things to talk about. We're always looking to enhance the visitor experience, prolong their stay, extend and do all of those things. And I think, you know, there's no doubt in my mind that multimedia and the potential of the technologies that are available to us today, and who knows where the future will lead us. Who would have ever thought 15 years ago or whenever it was that we WWW'd the first time, that we'd have known how the World Wide Web was just going to take over our lives. What a wonderful tool we have out there to access information, and these technologies that are available to us, and there's just the world and the sky's the limit, I think. We don't know where it's going to take us, but having an open mind and being ready to embrace it is all a part of just developing and extending that museum experience. So I think, is that all I need to say, Rachel? Rachel's going to lead us to the cup of tea, and thank you very much for being here today. Lovely to see you.
The National Museum of Australia in Canberra explores what it means to be Australian through our permanent galleries, exhibitions, public programs, and the National Historical Collection. Find out more about the museum at nma.gov.au, or download more audio programs from nma.gov.au/audio.